I have to tell you, I thought it was interesting that my subject is Providence. And when I couldn't get my flight on Friday, I wondered, well, maybe the Lord doesn't want me to go. But then when I talked to, Brother Bob, I'm standing at the counter trying to get a new flight, and the person in front of me, I was overhearing what they were saying to him, and they said, we only have a few seats to Philadelphia. And I said, Philadelphia, that's, you know, it's okay, but it's not New Jersey. And so while they were talking, I called Bob and I said, is Philadelphia close enough? And he says, well, I'll come and pick you up. And then he realized that he had information that Brother Len and Sister Gretchen were landing in Philadelphia 15 minutes before I was. And when I came down to get my luggage, within 30 seconds, I heard someone call out my name. And that was Brother Len. And I thought, my goodness, how in the world can I ever complain about anything when the Lord's hand is so clear? And you know, the point, one of the points of Providence is to teach us to trust Him when we see His hand working with us, that there is nothing in our lives that can harm us if we have faith and trust in Him. I want you to bring the love and greetings of your brethren in Chicago. Also, especially Brother Erwin Kalinske, who gave me a ride to the airport on Friday, and also my wife Cheryl, who gave me a ride to the airport on Saturday. And of course, all the brethren there. Well, brethren, this is probably more of a testimony than it is a discourse, so I hope you will bear with me. But you are all very strange in a very good way. Strange in the sense that you have had miracles in your lives, or your parents' lives, or your grandparents' lives, that have done something for you to bring you here today. And so one of my points today is for you to remember the miracles louder. Some of the miracles that have happened in your life, I'm going to share some that have happened in my family's life. Can we get the lights off? Thank you. Okay. Well, providence is something that should be very important to us. It's one of the ways that we have that helps us discern the Lord's will for us. We often hear Isaiah 30:21 associated with God's providence in our lives. It says, thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, when ye turn to the right hand and when ye turn to the left. And I love that scripture, but I realize that it's not always that easy. There is no literal word that comes from God that shows us if we should take the right or the left-hand path. And I think that's what makes understanding providence so difficult sometimes. And of course, another difficulty in properly understanding God's providence is our own will. We often want something to go a certain way so badly that we will see God's will through our own eyes rather than taking off the, what they call those, the rose-colored glasses, and being honest and forthright with ourselves at what really is His will. And sometimes you need to distinguish what your own will is first, not just your gut reaction, in order to distinguish it from the providences and overrulings of God. Well, simply, the dictionary definition of providence says that it is the foreseen care and guidance of God. And on reprint 1560, I thought that Brother Russell made some very excellent observations about divine providence. This is what he says. He says, to rightly understand the subject, we must carefully observe the scripturally marked meets and bounds within the limits of which divine providence can be and is exercised. And then he gives three limiting factors to divine providence. These are limits that God has put on Himself. For the first one, he says that since God is good, all His providences must be with a view to wise and benevolent ends, either near or remote. And second, since He made man in His own image, morally free, and with the alternatives of good and evil before him, it would be contrary to His purpose to hedge him about with His providences as to interfere with his free moral agency. And third, since God is working all things according to a plan of the ages, it is manifest that He cannot exercise His providence in any way which would be detrimental to the ultimate ends of His perfect plan. Well, brethren, those are excellent guidelines in our endeavor to understand how divine providence works. And so let me summarize it. It says, God's providence will only be exercised for wise and benevolent purposes. God's purposes will never overrule an individual's free moral agency. And God's providence will never contradict the purposes in the divine plan of the ages. And you know, in that same reprint article, I would encourage you all to read it, number 1560. Brother Russell talks about how God's providence is used to supervise the dominion of the universe. And that's the article where that wonderful quote is taken from, which says in part that God is the great emperor of the whole universe, and his wisdom, power, goodness, and benevolence are abundantly equal to all the responsibilities of so exalted an office. The human mind staggers in its efforts to comprehend the mental resources of a being who is able to assume and to bear such responsibility. And then he goes on from there to eloquently describe the memory that never fails, the judgment that never errs, the wisdom that plans for eternity without the possibility of failure. And I think, personally, it's one of the most moving paragraphs that Brother Russell ever wrote. And when I think about it, it makes me realize that when I think of providence, I usually think of it on a very small scale. The Lord intervenes in my life, in my little nothing of a life, and he overrules circumstances that I experience. And of course, that's true. But when we think of God as the creator of all things and the responsibility that he bears in maintaining his creation, we realize on how many different levels divine providence must work. The article goes on to say that no one can fully comprehend the providence of God. But oh, what a thrilling sense of mingled reverence, love, and adoration fills the heart when thus we catch a glimpse of the intellectual and moral glory and majesty of our God. As we thus contemplate him, all nature becomes eloquent with his praise. The heavens truly declare his glory, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Brethren, if we really could see, and someday we will, but if we could really see God's providences on its many different levels, as it works not only in the minutiae of our lives, but in the larger world around us, I think we would be in total awe at his ability. For today, I'd like to focus on the minutiae of one life in particular. And that's why I titled this talk, The Hand of Providence, A Testimony. And the story that I'm going to share with you, and some of you have heard this, sorry about that. But like I said earlier, I want this to be an opportunity for you to look at your lives or the life of your parents or even your grandparents and try to get a glimpse of the Lord's providence that happened in you to bring you here today. And to get us started on that exercise, I'm going to tell you about an experience in my father's life. And as I look back, it opens up an avenue of thought and understanding that has simply amazed me. And I will freely admit to you that I may not be grasping this properly of how God's providence acted in my dad's life. But if I am seeing what I think I am seeing, trying to take those rose-colored glasses off, then the Lord's providence may also have looked into the future, the family that he would have, that would someday consecrate and be members of people who are running for the prize of the high calling. And when I thought about that, I thought hard about that, and I wondered, well, does God do that? Does he look in the life of somebody and look into his future to see what that future holds? And the answer is, does he have the ability to do that? There's no question he has the ability to do that. We have scriptural examples of that. For example, and I'm not putting us in this category at all, but these are examples of God's ability. The Persian king Cyrus is mentioned in scripture by name some 150 years before he became king. This is Isaiah quoting the words of God. Before Cyrus was born, God says, he says to Cyrus, you are my shepherd. You will do what I want. You will say to Jerusalem, you will be rebuilt. You will tell the temple, your foundations will be put in place. Now, according to Josephus, when Cyrus heard of Isaiah's prophecy, he was convinced to allow Jews to return to Israel to rebuild the temple in the city of Jerusalem. He saw that there was a higher power working there, and so he wasn't going to fight against it. He was going to cooperate. And so the Lord was preparing the way for the work that Cyrus was to sponsor in rebuilding Israel after their captivity. And so here we see that God looked forward in time and prepared the way for Cyrus to accomplish what God had in his plan. You remember, too, in our studies of prophecy, we also know that Napoleon, although not specifically mentioned by name, is described in the book of Daniel. So we have at least some scriptural precedent of how the Lord can look into the future and know who will be there and what the circumstances will be. Well, I got to tell you, brethren, I think I've seen that in my family's life. And I want to put a disclaimer. This is not meant to brag or to say my family is any more special than anyone else. Please don't get that from what I'm saying. This is simply what I believe is my family's providence and how the Lord has dealt with us over three generations. Like I said earlier, please take this as an opportunity for you to look into your family's providences and what brought you to the Lord. Every one of you has a story. Every one of you has a miracle and a providence somewhere, and that should give you more confidence in your relationship with Him. When I was growing up, I would hear stories about my father's experiences during World War II, and I heard bits and pieces of some very interesting experiences. And when I became an adult, I understood that, you know, these were significant enough that I should preserve them. And so I did an interview with him, and I recorded it, and he told us in great detail of his war experiences, of how even then he saw the Lord's hand in his life. And I started out my recording by simply saying, well, tell us your story. And he kind of offhandedly says, ah, what's there to tell? And I thought, man, there was a lot to tell. And I think he knew it. And a little later, I'm going to let you hear his own words about the Lord's care over this insignificant Italian soldier during World War II who was stationed at the Russian front during the height of winter. The experiences for him began when he was drafted into the Italian army. Of course, he was born and raised in Sicily. This was, of course, before he became a Bible student, before he knew anything about the truth. And in all of these experiences for him, I think of the tabernacle picture of how the Lord begins the drawing process while people are still out into the camp, wandering and looking for something better. And when something draws them closer to that first door, there's interest that brings them there. And so in this time in his life, I think my dad was out there. He was out in the camp. He was really no different than anyone else in the world. He wasn't in covenant relationship with the Lord, but these experiences would draw him closer when he saw the hand of God working. His initial time of service was 18 months. This was before the war. And he requested to be stationed in Africa. And I said, well, why would you want to go to Africa? And he says, well, it paid more. I had never been there before, so I thought it would be interesting. There was no war going on for the Italians at this time. And so he was in Africa for 18 months. So it wasn't difficult for him. He was actually in Libya. And after his service in Libya, he was discharged from the army. But after a short time, he was drafted again because on June 10th, 1940, Italy had entered the war. As you know, Italy was part of the Axis power allied with Germany. And when I was a kid, I didn't like that. You know, he was on Germany's side, you know. He's an American. He should have been on the American side. But, of course, that wasn't up to him. He had to do what he was told. There was no conscientious objector positions then. And after initial training as an auto mechanic, he was sent to a post near Rome. And when he got there, he met a good friend of his who he had known in Sicily, who happened to be the colonel of the base. And because they were friends, he was able to stay there for about 6 months, which he thought was a blessing, a providence. But unfortunately, in 1942, there were no easy jobs in the Italian army. He was sent to the Russian front. And it was a 2-week train ride to Russia. The Italian dictator, Benito Mussolini, believed that the war would be short, that Germany was so powerful that victory was assured, and so he wanted to claim his share of the conquered territories. He actually wanted to reestablish the glory of the Roman Empire. You see how deluded he was. Now, there have been a number of books written about the Italian army's experience at the Russian front. I'd like to quote from one of the books titled Few Returned. It was written by a young Italian lieutenant who was in Russia at the same time and whose descriptions matched what my dad said in the recording almost exactly. This is what he writes. It says, the Italian fighting units sent to the Eastern Front in the summer of 1941 were held in utter contempt by their German ally. The Italian 8th Army was deemed fit only for a minor defensive role, and they saw little significant action until late 1942, when the Russians assembled 4 armies consisting of 1 million troops, nearly 1,000 tanks, and an equal number of attack aircraft, launched a giant 2-pronged winter counteroffensive across a wide front in southern Russia. The 8th Army was simply no match against this massive Red Army juggernaut and was quickly overwhelmed. Not only were the Italians woefully clothed, but they also lacked tanks and anti-tank guns with which to defend themselves. Within hours, the Don River front disintegrated. To avoid death or capture, the Italian and German troops trapped in the Don Pocket began retreating in a desperate attempt to break free of encirclement. The flight of the Italians became a horrific odyssey, carried out in extreme sub-zero temperatures, often as low as minus 30 degrees. Unlike the Germans, who were occasionally resupplied by air, the Italians were left largely to fend for themselves, with only whatever each individual soldier could carry on his own back or drag on makeshift sleds. The Italians were generally clad in warm weather shoes that many replaced with straw and blankets torn into strips and wrapped around their feet. Bereft of ammunition, resupply, or transport, the Italians marched on foot across the bleak, frozen wilderness of Russia, virtually without sleep, in the dead of winter, through some of the most desolate terrain on earth. They left in their wake a trail of corpses and abandoned equipment. Only the fittest and the luckiest survived the 28-day ordeal. Finally, in mid-January 1943, the survivors at last managed to break free of the Russian trap. The Italian Eighth Army had ceased to exist. In addition to those who died in the fighting during the retreat from the Don River, the official Italian historians later determined that some 50 to 60,000 Italian soldiers were captured by the Russians and sent to POW camps. Only 10,300 were later repatriated. The rest are thought to have died from abuse, starvation, and disease in the unspeakable conditions of captivity. Well, you know, brethren, that World War II had many horror stories of suffering and tragedy. My dad and his fellow soldiers could not have known what they were getting into, of course. And there we see that the greed and misguided leadership of Mussolini brought terrible consequences to the Italian people. And so my dad was simply part of a history that will not soon be forgotten, part of the necessary consequences of the permission of evil when fallen men are allowed to foster their ambitious schemes. Now, what he told me in my interview with him parallels exactly what is recorded in this book. He even used similar terminology. He had said that the Russians had them surrounded like they were in a sack and that they were no longer in a fight. Those Italians were there simply for survival. And I wasn't aware of that book before my father died. My older brother Joe had come across it. And I think if I had known about that book, I would have asked him if he knew the author, Eugenio Corti. Because his descriptions are so close to what my dad described. They were experiencing the same things. In fact, there's one interesting overlap that I'll mention in a little bit between my dad's story and what was in the book. On his way to Russia in the train, my dad described seeing men jackhammering the ice of a river in order to get water. And he said the ice looked like it was 3 feet thick. He said he even saw trucks driving on the river as if they were on roads. And I looked it up. I read that rivers in that part of Russia are frozen from early November to early May. You know, picture the contrast for him. He was born and raised in Sicily, never had been off the island for his whole life until then. He had never seen anything like this. He was a young 26-year-old at the time. And I asked him how he stayed warm. And he said, well, you know, the Germans had excellent boots. And because he was a sergeant, he was given a pair of those boots. He said they were high insulated boots. And when he put them on, he said, my feet were like they were in an oven. And, you know, I doubt that they really were that warm. But you know what he meant in comparison to what they were before. He also said they had taken a wool cap off of a dead soldier that helped keep his head warm. And one story that he told was when the Russians were closing in because the Italians had run out of gas. They couldn't use any of their equipment. His army was all spread out, and as he walked, he found two horses and a wagon, probably something similar to this vintage one on the screen. He took it. It was just sitting there by itself. And he started riding in the wagon. He picked up four or five other Italian soldiers who were having trouble walking. But as the Russians closed in, they took about 1,000 Italian prisoners, including my dad and the horse and the wagon and the Italian soldiers who were on there with them. And as they continued riding the wagon, they were coming out of the valley. And the Germans, who were at the top of the valley, thought they were gonna shoot the Italians because they thought they had simply given up. Well, there's nothing they could have done to fight, and so they were easily taken captive. The Russian commander who was in charge of the prisoners somehow communicated to my dad that he wanted them to get off the wagon and march with the other soldiers. And my dad says, well, we can't do that because these men can't even walk anymore. he kind of laughed. He says, that probably wasn't true. They probably could have walked, but at least it kept them in the wagon. And the Russian commander then understood, and he ordered one Russian soldier to accompany them to take them back as prisoners to go back to the rear of the Russian front. And as they went on, they saw both the Germans and the Russians were shooting at each other. My dad says, why don't we go a different way? That's not a good way to go. And so he suggested they go down into the valley to avoid the fighting. And the Russian guard saw the reason in that, and he agreed. And so they ended up going away from the fighting that was at the top of the valley. And sometime later, the wagon hit a tree stump and the harness broke. And so they stopped to fix the harness, and the Russian soldier said, do you have any food on that wagon? And my dad didn't know. He looked around, and he found some food in the back of the wagon. And with that food, he also found what he said were two or three barrels of honey. Now, he called them barrels. I don't know how big they really were. But they sat for about an hour eating, and when they fixed the wagon, they kept going. And they eventually came across some small Russian huts similar to this one. And when they went in, they found that the hut was full of wounded Italian soldiers. And so my dad was able to share the honey with the wounded soldiers. Now, I don't know that that would be much of a meal, but when you're starving, you will eat anything. And this is where the story overlaps with the book, because the book also mentions that someone had found some honey and shared it with others. And when I read that in the book, I said, there's my dad. There's the crossover. There's a connection with this book and this other fellow's story. And I wondered, what were the odds of finding two horses and a wagon that had food in it in the middle of a Russian winter during a brutal war? And I thought the hand of providence seemed to be acting for him. And after a while, the Russian soldier wanted to leave because there was a counteroffensive coming from the Germans. But my dad again says, well, none of these guys can walk. There's nothing that you can do to get them to go back to the Russian rear. So rather than shooting them, which would have been a customary thing for a Russian soldier to do, he just left. And so they were no longer prisoners. And, you know, I hadn't paid much attention to that part of the story until I read what I read to you earlier about what happened to most of the prisoners who were taken by the Russians. The men in that hut were spared that experience because of that lie. Well, maybe it wasn't so much of a lie that they couldn't walk anymore. And I suppose in certain situations, a white lie can save someone's life. The Lord may have touched that Russian soldier's heart just to leave him alone. They had found food for him. They had given him a ride on their cart. So the Russian soldier just left. And I'll show you one thing. Although it's very tarnished now, my dad was actually awarded the silver medal for his help with the wounded. He kind of laughed. He says, you know, I might have gotten a gold medal, but those were reserved for people who were wounded. And the Lord took such good care of me, I was never wounded, so I only got the silver. I thought that was pretty funny. Anyway, of the 30,000 Italian soldiers who were surrounded by the Russians, only 4,000 survived. That's only 13%. And my dad was one of them in part of that long march west out of Russia. He also told of one incident that as he was walking, he saw a helmet on the ground and thought, you know, it'd be a good idea to put this on. And within moments of putting it on his head, a random bullet zinged him right on the helmet. And he said that his ears were ringing for at least half an hour. Boy, was he glad he put that helmet on. And in his broken English, he said, the Lord provides in everything. I don't know what the Lord can do. Not sure what he meant by that, because it's not very good English, but I think what he meant was that he hadn't realized the type of miracles that the Lord could do. Who would think of putting on a helmet and have a bullet hit you in the head moments later that the Lord cares about somebody enough to do that? Well, as he walked further, he said that a bomb exploded near him. His coat was shred from the shrapnel, but none of it touched him. And so there was another deliverance for him. Under those brutal conditions, almost any type of wound would have been fatal. Now, at one place they came across the soldiers nicknamed Death Valley because there were so many dead men that they were literally walking on top of them. And as they kept walking west, they came to a large city and found deep trenches that the Russians had dug. They had dug them for protection, but the trenches were full of dead Russian soldiers. And that's where my dad had picked up the cap off a dead Russian. He laughed and said, well, he wasn't going to need it anymore, and it was going to do me a lot of good. And now he was wearing German boots, a Russian hat, and, of course, his flimsy Italian coat. And he said again, when I put on that Russian cap, my head was like it was in an oven. He appreciated the difference good clothing made. I asked him how he kept his hands warm, and he says, well, I was very careful never to touch anything metal, and I kept my hands in my pocket every moment that I could. And as I look back, I think about that. I remember looking at his hands and thinking how bad they looked. They were very rough and dry and hard. And selfishly, I thought, oh, boy, I hope my hands don't end up being like that. But I think these were the after effects of being in Russia in the winter. You know, this was such a chaotic and confusing retreat that as he walked, at one point he found himself alone. And again, something unusual happened. He came across a single horse that was tied up, and he tried to get on the horse, but he couldn't. He was too weak. And so he took the horse over to a little hill where he can climb up the hill, and then he got on. And so he was able to ride for a while. And as he rode a little way, he came across two German soldiers who said that that horse belonged to them. And he says, well, I didn't know. It was just there by itself. I saw it, and I was having trouble walking, so I took it. So he got down from the horse, and he gave it back to the Germans. And I'm going to play for you a part of the audio in my dad's own words so you can see what happened next. I'll have the words on the screen because you may not be able to understand too easily what he said. So are we ready? Okay, here we go.
After he was a horse, he walked about 5-6 foot away from me and started shooting my leg with the machine gun. And another guy said, stop it, why are you shooting for? One stop, one shooting, another guy stop. Man decides, maybe he can't be shooting more, you know. So when he finished shooting, I see my coat full of holes with the shooting. I look at my leg, and my leg was broken. Nothing happened to my leg. And they wanted to put something on my leg. Put the hand anyway. By the way, the Lord never leave for 1 minute. A lot of people who tear the fruits and everything, they didn't want to hear it fall on my head. Nothing. Thank the Lord until now.
I like the way he said that. Maybe the Lord put something around my legs. He put his hand anyway. The Lord never lead me for 1 minute. Not even one hair fell off my head. Brethren, that's providence. And so as I think about what the Lord did for my dad, I have to think that he did it for me too and for my family. And I ask again, is that possible that the Lord looks ahead to see what a man will become and adjusts his providence? And I'll tell you, I wouldn't be surprised if he did. And if he did, it shows a being with more wisdom and power than we can possibly understand. And if I am grasping all this correctly, it's given me a message that not only do I owe the Lord a great debt, but I owe it to my dad as well, because the Lord must have seen something in him to do these things for him. And all that gives me a responsibility to live the most dedicated life that I can, because that's really the best way to show that I appreciate all this and realize that this isn't just a story. This is God's hand moving in the life of my family. And I hope that my kids and even maybe future family members can see that lesson as well and be moved by the possibility that the Lord could look ahead multiple generations and see that those generations are worth this effort. Well, brethren, the story doesn't end there by any means. I hope I'm not taking too much time with my personal testimony, but I just want to tell you the rest of that story, at least part of the rest of it. When my dad finally got back to Italy, he was given a month's leave to rest and recuperate. And at the end of his leave, he went back north to his regiment. And just about that time, Italy signed an armistice agreement with the Allied powers. The war was over for Italy, or so they thought. Hitler was so enraged by what he called Italy's betrayal that he sent German troops to occupy Italy. The Italian army was disbanded, and there was no protection for any of its soldiers. And my dad, along with other Italian soldiers, were arrested by the Germans, who they had been allied with. He was arrested here somewhere between Naples and Rome. They were put on a cattle car, like you've seen on television with the Jews, and they were packed like animals, and they were headed north to Germany. And I asked him why they were going to Germany, and he says, well, probably to work. We were young and strong and healthy, so I assumed they were being taken to a POW camp. But he also says, I wasn't sure why we were going, but I was sure I didn't want to go. And so he tried to find a way to escape. He had noticed two small windows near the top of the boxcar and decided that at some point he was going to try to get out of that one of those windows. Here's a picture of a Nazi boxcar that was being brought to a museum in Florida, actually. You can see their little window at the top. Now, this particular one has barbed wire over it. My dad didn't say anything about barbed wire, so either his didn't have it or he was able to squeeze through it. He escaped somewhere north of Bologna after traveling some 350 miles on the train. He says that the night he escaped was pitch black, no moon. And as the train approached the station, it slowed down enough that he could jump out that small window. And when he landed, he said he had to kneel motionless next to the track because there were German soldiers sitting at each end of the boxcars. And after the train finally passed, he walked until he saw a small farmhouse. And when he knocked on the door, the people inside were afraid to open because it was night. And so they said, well, we're not going to open, but you could sleep in our barn. And he did, and the next morning he told them that he had to get out of this uniform. And all he wanted was a change of clothes. And so they gave him a change of clothes. He actually walked back to the train station where he had jumped off, and he bought a ticket back south to Rome. But Rome was not a good place for a young Italian man. It was dangerous. Here's a picture of Italian civilians being arrested in Rome by German troops following a partisan attack a day earlier. So though they had been allied with Germany, because of the Italian armistice, they now became enemies and had to endure German occupation. And it's not clear when or how, but at some point my dad's brother had given him a name of a family in Rome that he could contact if he ever needed help. He somehow found that family. He asked them for help, but they were afraid of the Germans, and they said they weren't going to help him. But they knew of a family who might. And so they gave him another family's address, and when he found them, they were willing to help him. And he said that he hid in their house for about 9 months. During those 9 months, there was one stretch that he had not gone outside for 3 consecutive months. He said the family ran a small business where they made socks and sweaters. They had a special sewing machine for socks. And, of course, he wanted to contribute somehow to this family. And so we learned how to make socks. And he says, you know, the first day I made 30 pairs of socks for them. Well, on June 4th, 1944, the Allies took Rome, and the war was finally over for him so he could go home back to Sicily. Well, that's the story of my dad's war experience. There's another series of events that led him to the Bible students. Some of you in this room contributed to that, and some of you in this room contributed to the growth of his family, and for that I will forever be in your debt. But I will let you judge for yourself if there were divine providences here. The German boots that saved his feet, the Russian hat that helped him stay warm, the horses and the wagon that gave him a ride and food, the honey that he found, the helmet and the bullet that had stopped, the bomb exploding and shredding his coat but not hurting him, not being taken prisoner to Russia or resting in that Russian hut, the German firing a machine gun at his legs without anything touching him, the escape from that Russian sack, that terrible 28 days, the escape from a Nazi prisoner camp, and the help of strangers in Rome. And I wonder, can all that be coincidence? And I think that might take more imagination to think that that was all luck than to see it as the hand of God moving in his life. And what is amazing about this story is that I think we get a glimpse of the extremes of divine providence. Germany was not going to win the war. There is no question about that. The Lord was going to make sure of that. In fact, the German loss in Russia was a turning point of the war. It showed the world that Germany was not invincible. As the German invasion struggled through that terrible Russian winter, it had no more success in spring when the ground thawed and turned to impassable mud, trapping the German vehicles. At least in winter, their trucks could go. But man, when it got warm, they could not move a bit. And so on a large scale, Providence worked to defeat the Axis forces. But within that large providence, the Lord saw this insignificant Italian soldier who was on the German side, but a man who had a good heart and was willing to help others. So providence worked on a small scale with one individual, while at the same time working on a larger scale to control the outcome of the war. It just illustrates how the Lord can deal with every detail and doesn't miss anything. The Italians lost the war, but some Italians were saved and allowed to prosper. And I think what discernment the Lord shows in his dealings. And again, brethren, I encourage you to look into your past and try to see the Lord's hand in your family's history. And realize the responsibility that puts on each of us. We can only repay the blessings that past generations have given to us by the way we live our lives today. It's an intriguing exercise to try and understand how the Lord has been intervening in man's affairs. And of course, the outcome of World War II is a very clear providence. God's plan would not be advanced by a German victory. Providence even used the evil intent of the Nazis to prepare the way for the rebirth of Israel. I love this passage. The psalmist says, "Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain." The end of the war was God restraining the evil that was in the intent of the German nation. And I close with the words that I read earlier from Brother Russell. A glimpse of God's providence gives us a thrilling sense of mingled reverence, love, and adoration of the intellectual and moral glory of God. I will tell you the next part of the story that is just as thrilling. My mother was an American citizen, believe it or not. Her parents came to the United States when she was very young. No, before she was born. They moved to southern Illinois, and my grandfather was a coal miner. And in that time, she was born, so she was an American citizen. But after 5 years maybe, he hated coal mining so badly, he says, Italy was a lot better than this, so they moved back to Italy. But it gave her the citizenship that she needed to come back. And when she married my dad, they wanted all their children to be born here because they knew America was better. But he couldn't come. She came by herself. She was on a boat. She was pregnant with my older brother. She took the boat for, I think it took a month and a half to get here. She landed in New York, didn't speak a word of English. She had a brother in Chicago. And so somehow she got from New York to Chicago on a train. I don't know how. But, the older generation back then who immigrated were courageous people. And they did things most of us maybe wouldn't do. And so then about a year and a half later, my dad was able to immigrate and come to this country. But they were very religiously inclined. Everyone in Sicily was Catholic and religious, but they weren't Catholic. They were Pentecostal, but not in the way we know it. Pentecostals then were very different. They didn't speak in tongues, but they were very conservative, no jewelry. Everything was carefully controlled in a way. And they wanted to continue having meetings, and so my mother's brother says, well, there's this little Italian group that meet on Sunday, so you should meet with them. And we did. We would go to this little church in Chicago, and the pastor was very nice. I think it was a Presbyterian church, but we didn't go to his church. After their meetings were over, they would have a little congregational meeting with this Italian group of friends that my parents knew. And the providence in this was that there was an Italian brother who also knew the Chicago Bible students. And he would go back and forth. He knew this Italian group. I think there was an Italian affinity there. But he also knew that the Chicago Bible students had the truth. And one day he said to my parents, you need to meet them. You need to talk to the Bible students because they have the truth. And my parents said, we don't speak English. That's an American class. What good will that do us? So this brother Morello, he talked to some of the Chicago brethren. And he suggested that they come to meet with us. And I remember Brother Carl and Brother George Tabak, Brother Ron Proskin, and Sister Marilee used to come. And she used to take care of my brother and myself because we were pretty young. And she would have Bible classes with us in the other room, and she would give us handwriting lessons. And she would tell us that, some good people are going to live right through the kingdom. They won't die. And I remember thinking, Marilee's going to live right through the kingdom, and she'll never die. And thinking, that's not what she wants, But she was such a noble teacher for us. And once in a while, when they're really having trouble, they would ask me to come in and translate because I knew a little of both languages. And so finally my parents were convinced to start attending the Sunday meeting. But that little Italian brother, Brother Morello, I don't know whatever happened to him, where he went, or what happened, but in my opinion, he was an angel. You know, and angels don't have to be spirits. They could be human. And so that's how my family came into the truth. And so something the Lord saw in them, there was a hunger in them, a dissatisfaction with what they knew. But they didn't know what was better. They just knew there was something better. And so that little connection was the rest of the story for my parents. And so now, you know, my dad's family's came into the truth. My kids are both consecrated. And it all happened way back in World War II where it all started. But all along the way, there were providences and overrulings for us to come into the truth. And I am so thankful for that. That those little things that my dad did and my parents did have such a beneficial effect on multiple generations that follow. So brethren, don't ever think that your life doesn't have an impact on others. It does.